Milwaukee Journal Sentinel Milwaukee Bucks podcast, joining you in the aftermath of a pretty disappointing end of the season. The Milwaukee Bucks, as you all know, have lost their Eastern Conference semifinal matchup with the Miami Heat 4-1. They were able to scratch and claw their way to a Game 4 win in overtime on Sunday, but with Giannis Antetokounmpo sidelined by an ankle that took him out for most of Game 4, he was unavailable for Game 5, and the Bucks did what they could, ultimately fell to the Miami Heat by 9 points. Season over. Disappointment commences. My name is J.R. Radcliffe, host of the Milwaukee Bucks Journal Sentinel podcast, and on the other line is Matt Velasquez. He covers the Milwaukee Bucks for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He had it's an unusual time to have covered it from his living room, given that everything. I can't imagine, Matt, that you thought that the Bucks season would end while you were in your living room before all of this happened. But here we are. Very unusual way to be writing a season obituary for the Milwaukee Bucks, I have to think.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, 2020's been some type of year. You know, the fact that, you know, someone texted me yesterday kind of saying like, oh yeah, it's probably a little early to be breaking things down or whatever earlier than you thought, like based off of, you know, how far, you know, the Bucks were expected to go. And I was like, well, it's actually a lot later than I thought. It's September and I'm still writing about the Bucks 2019-2020 season. But not being there, you know, having them play, you know, 18 games in the bubble where I wasn't there. I mean, that's just weird. After, you know, being with them, you know, all the time for the better part of 3 seasons, and to have to watch it all on TV with a delay, and you know, not being able to have the same access to players and coaches and really be able to read the room. And I mean, the only room I'm in is my like living room, my dining room, my bedroom. Like, those are the only rooms I can read. So it's been weird. It's been unusual, but you know, glad to be able to be doing it. And trying to kind of figure things out as best I can from the spot that I'm in. Cause I know that 2020 has been weird for me. It's been weird for you. It's been weird for the Bucks. It's been weird for everybody out there. There is no normal. So we're just trying to embrace whatever reality we have in front of us.
Yeah. So like you said, the room is a little tough to read, but we're going to try to do as much as we can. We're going to speculate as much as we can, because quite honestly, we could go back and talk about why things fell apart against Miami. I don't know if we need to rehash it much. Miami had a great game plan against Giannis, able to limit him as much as anyone can. Giannis was still able, of course, to get his, I mean, 19 points in 11 minutes on a bum ankle in Game 4 before he had to leave is indicative of just how great Giannis is capable of being, even in the face of a defense that was able to slow him down. Offense didn't click when the Bucks defense was working on all cylinders. Game 5 in particular, the Bucks played very well defensively, were not able to put the ball in the basket. Eric Bledsoe in particular struggling from the field. As good of a defender as he is, he just has struggled on offense in the playoffs. And we'll talk about that, but let's cut right to the chase, because this ultimately, when we talk about the Bucks season ending, the first topic of conversation is what comes next for Giannis Antetokounmpo. He is eligible to sign the Supermax extension this offseason. The finances of the NBA have shifted with the pandemic, with the loss of revenue, all of that stuff. And now the situation has changed. We've always said the Bucks that winning is number one for Giannis. He now is in a situation where they've been sort of unceremoniously dropped from the playoffs 2 years in a row, short of the first NBA Finals in this town's history since 1974. And this is an aging team that maybe it's going to need an overhaul, or maybe overhaul is too strong, but certainly going to need some improvements to get past this point that they've reached. He did say after the game to Yahoo Sports that he is not going to demand a trade, that he says he, you know, that's not going to happen. Some encouraging comments for Bucks fans, in fact, him talking about, you know, not just hitting a wall and trying to do something else, that his, similar to what he said in the past, he wants to stay in Milwaukee. He wants to keep going, build something here. I'm curious about your reaction to these comments. Again, we've heard this sort of thing before. Is there something that resonates differently when you hear him say these things in the aftermath of a 5-game loss in the Eastern Conference semifinals, or is this just right online? Maybe this doesn't offer any additional insight into what Giannis might ultimately decide to do when it comes to signing the Supermax extension.
this is Giannis. Like, these are the things we've heard before. You know, being around him for as long as I have, this is very much on brand, on message, you know, saying all the things that, I would expect him to say. I think he's pretty forceful in the way that he came off, you know, in those comments, but it doesn't really change kind of his mentality and things like that. Now, that all said, that still doesn't mean he's going to sign the Supermax. You know, he did say that, yes, like he's not going to push for a trade. He's not going to demand a trade. You know, that's just not who he is. I mean, I don't think any of us thought that was who he is. This also isn't a situation like Anthony Davis in New Orleans where he didn't get along. He's not getting along with the organization and the team isn't having any success. You know, this is a two-time MVP on the best regular season team in back-to-back seasons. You know, that, you know, who knows how things would have gone if it weren't for COVID-19 and for having to play in the bubble and for, you know, delaying their season and all that. We'll never know. You know, but I think that, you know, the Supermax is still a thing that it's hard to know if he will sign it. And I don't say that to mean that he's not going to stay. I mean that as, you know, it might not be the best financial decision to lock yourself in, not necessarily knowing exactly what the cap is going to be or what it's going to look like. You know, the Supermax is 35% of the cap. And, you know, it would be based off of the cap in the 2021-2022 season. We don't know what that's going to be yet. We don't know if there's going to be some smoothing on the part of the NBA, if the NBA Players Association and the league are going to come up with a plan to kind of like artificially keep the salary cap up, because right now it's based off of revenue and revenue is going to be down. So all of that hasn't been hammered out yet. So if you're Giannis, like, you're going to want to figure out, like, what am I tying myself into? You know, am I potentially, you know, losing money if I do that? So, you know, he could wait. He could try and figure out what the future is going to look like from a financial standpoint for the league, and you know, sign it later. He could decide that he wants to, you know, sign a one-year deal, you know, with an option for more or the ability to sign the Supermax in the future. He could decide he wants to sign a three-year deal. And then that would put him at 10 years of service, which would give him the opportunity to, at that point, sign, I believe, what is called a super duper max, because he'd be a 10 year veteran, which comes with a pay bump. He gets to a little bit of a different pay scale, and he'd go higher on the max contract scale. So, you know, there are some different things he can do. I think that, you know, at the very least, we can expect that he is going to do everything he can in the remaining season he has under contract in Milwaukee. And beyond that, I think there's a lot of variables, not just for Giannis, but for the Bucks and for the league as a whole, that need to be figured out, that I think will help inform that decision.
And some of these maneuvers that the Bucks might make here in the next couple of years from a personnel standpoint, surely to inform that, and we'll be talking about those in some depth here, but the biggest, I would say, the biggest thing under the microscope that the Bucks faced over the last, you know, week and a half in this Heat series was Coach Mike Budenholzer. Nationally, locally, I think anytime a team that comes in as the top seed underperforms, you know, according to chalk, you're going to get some criticism for the coaching. But I think more than ever before, his style, his sort of unwillingness to adjust, I guess, is a criticism he hears a lot. It's come under scrutiny. And I struggle with it myself, because I can't bring myself to criticize a coach who's been with the Bucks two seasons, and both seasons the Bucks have the best record in the regular season. I totally understand that playoffs are a different animal; they're what you're judged on. But I mean, you can't do better regular season wise than what he was able to do. They go in with the top seed. It felt like last year they ran into a buzzsaw in the Toronto Raptors, a team that was just playing at an elite level, a team that went on to win the title. And I feel like that you can't criticize Mike Budenholzer for that. But now you see the Heat series, now you look at the Raptor series, you look at his time in Atlanta, there's starting to be a pattern, and it was never more under the microscope than when the Bucks than when he elected not to play guys like Giannis and Middleton a really huge, more than 40 minutes in Game 3. I think we look back and we sort of have to acknowledge that what he was probably doing was sort of taking the fall for him wanting to limit Giannis on a bulky ankle, not trying to get him hurt any more so than he ultimately became. But I guess I don't know what's legitimate in the criticism of Mike Budenholzer. I don't know if there's a legitimate threat that he's not back as Bucks coach as the team tries to keep Giannis for a longer term deal. Certainly there doesn't seem to be any animosity, but if he is the thing that's holding this Bucks team back, you know, as I try to find the thing that's holding the Milwaukee Bucks back, it's very difficult to isolate. And many people have sort of zeroed in on the coach. What do you think of that criticism that he's been dealing with here the last few days? Do you think it's fair? Do you think the team entertains another coach? I mean, where do you sort of fall on all of that?
Well, I have a lot of feelings. I think that there's not just one thing that you know ended the Bucks season. I don't think it was just Budenholzer. I don't think it was just the roster. I don't think it was individual players. But I think it's all of those things put together. I think that, you know, I always wonder, and I don't know if I'll ever get an answer to this or anyone will, but like, to what extent is Budenholzer determining the minutes, or how much is it the medical staff, you know, indicating, okay, this is how, you know, players play at their peak. This is the data that we have, you know, so this is how you should do it. And maybe that is backed by the front office or ownership or the coach, whatever it is. I don't know. I don't know how much influence, you know, the medical staff has, or is that a bud thing, limiting guys' minutes? Cause I know that we've watched seasons in the past, you know, particularly under Jason Kidd, where Giannis and Chris Middleton were playing like 40 minutes every night. Like that was just like a normal thing. I think there was a year that Chris Middleton, either led or nearly led the NBA in minutes. So, you know, we've seen this in the past. Like we know that this can happen. You know, but I think that all the criticisms of Bud are, I think they're generally fair. You know, the Bucks have banked on, you know, this idea that they know exactly who they are. They know exactly what they do. And if they are who they want to be and they do what they want to do, that's good enough. And it is good enough in the regular season when teams aren't, you know, focused on your particular strengths and weaknesses and making adjustments that are catered to beating you. You know, most times in the regular season, they don't have a chance to practice. They're not doing an intensive film study or preparations for a single team. You know, they'll have assistant coaches do a scout and they'll have, you know, bullet points that they'll lay out and shoot around and, you know, in pregame and stuff like that, of like tendencies and things guys can do to stop their team, but it's not as intense as the playoffs. And so, you know, with the Bucks being who they are, teams will spend all, you know, they have a season's worth of clips and things to use to prepare to combat the Bucks. And you saw the Orlando Magic make things difficult in the first round, even though they did not have as much talent, but they were feisty. They had a clear plan and they executed it as well as they could. To at least make the Bucks sweat. You know, it was a 4-1 series, but a lot of those games were pretty close, even though the Bucks ended up winning by double digits. They didn't feel comfortable. And then you take a Miami team that has better athletes, that has better talent, that has better depth, and has better coaching. You know, Eric Spoelstra's been, you know, been to the mountaintop. He's coached stars. He's coached teams that, you know, have struggled. He's coached teams that have overperformed. You know, and he's kind of set a culture and, you know, has become one of the better coaches in the NBA. And I think he came in with his guys prepared, knowing exactly what they needed to do. And the Bucks just, you know, because they do the things that they do and they try to do them, you know, well and try to continually do them, they just didn't have a counterpunch. You know, I know that in, you know, years like compared to last year, they did more posting up of, you know, Brooke Lopez, and they had let Chris Middleton shoot more mid-range shots and a few different things on offense. But for the most part, you know, this was the same Bucks. You know, on defense, they do what they do. They don't switch as much. And that led to the best defense in the league in the regular season. And you can, I guess, say that, oh, well, they just didn't execute well enough in the playoffs. It's like, but there's also could be a flaw in that plan when teams are getting wide open shots. You know, if you're daring teams to shoot wide open shots, you know, throughout a season, you know, you can kind of weather that, right? Like, you know, teams shot more threes against the Bucks all year, but they still had the best defensive efficiency. Well, in a compressed 5-game series, if you're going to be okay with, you know, leaving Jay Crowder open in order to protect the paint, you're leaving the opportunity open for Jay Crowder to go off, which, you know, I think he did pretty well. He didn't shoot, you know, he didn't make every shot, but he made enough of them to really strain the Bucks defense. And, you know, when you have those possessions ending in made threes, it can get disheartening. It can drag you down. You know, you also look at fourth quarters, the Bucks just didn't have another gear to go to. You know, the game one, they led for most of the game and just didn't have the ability to stop Jimmy Butler or find their offense against the ratcheted up Heat defense. And then they lost by double digits. Game two, they came a Giannis hand touch away from forcing overtime, despite not playing well for a lot of that game. You know, game three, they're by 12 going into the fourth quarter, and they let go of the rope. So, you know, when it came time to put up or shut up, like in the fourth quarters of games, you know, outside of game four, which took a Herculean effort, the Bucks just didn't have it. And I think some of that, you know, definitely has to do with coaching and the way that they have set themselves up and the things that they've decided to do and not playing guys and the schemes and all of that. I think there's also some blame for, you know, okay, Giannis is your best player. You know, he's the one who makes everything work. And we saw some progression in terms of his shot during the season, but it wasn't there in this series. He didn't have, you know, anything that he could do other than try and go to the hoop and either score for himself in traffic or kick out to teammates. And, you know, when those teammates aren't making shots, when he is not finishing inside, when he's not getting foul calls, that just doesn't provide enough, you know, different options for the Bucks on offense. I think that his ability to stretch his game out a little bit, to keep defenses honest, not just with threes, but like you saw Bam Adebayo in this series, just, you know, killing the Bucks with 18 footers. You know, they would leave him open, they would sink off of him, and, you know, he shot around 50%, a little bit over 50% on those mid-range shots. Like, that's a pretty good weapon. You know, and so, you know, the Bucks didn't do enough schematically to find new ways to get Giannis open. It was kind of just put the ball in his hands and let him go. There was some off-ball movement and screening, but definitely not enough. There were times they played through Chris Middleton, Eric Bledsoe, as you mentioned before, just didn't step up in the way the Bucks need him. And it's really hard to have him and Giannis on the court together when neither of them is really that much of a threat. Every team will live with those guys shooting open shots, and you know, that creates a, you know, a roster fit that, you know, just may not be something the Bucks can rely on for the future. Just a whole lot of things. I could keep going about the composition of the team and the things that the Bucks have done, but long story short, I think that, you know, the Bucks can and should take a long look at Budenholzer and have conversations about what direction they want to go in and what changes they want to make and how they want to handle things going forward. And it'll be, you know, I think it could be on the table that they can make a coaching change. We've seen weirder things in the NBA. We saw Nate McMillan get extended and then fired like a week later. We've seen, you know, Billy Donovan lead the Thunder to a surprising, you know, great season this year after losing Russell Westbrook and bringing back Chris Paul and having a bunch of young guys. And now he and the Thunder are mutually agreeing to part ways and not pursue a contract extension. Like, things happen with NBA coaching that are unusual. I mean, I wouldn't rule out anything when it comes to Budenholzer, his future with the Bucks. Though it is worth mentioning that, you know, he is under contract for two more years, and the Bucks would have to eat that salary, you know, and continue to pay him for those 2 years, while also probably having to pay a pretty penny to bring in somebody else. I'm not sure who exactly that would be or who the best fit would be, but they have to pay them too. And so, with all the financial implications of the pandemic and the way this season has gone, that could be a tough pill to swallow, you know, for the Bucks ownership. But that's a decision they're going to have to make, whether they believe that Budenholzer can be the guy who can get this team over the top after failing to do so each of the past two seasons, or if they're going to need to find somebody else, because their championship window, it's not going to stay open forever.
Yeah, that's a very tough puzzle that you present there, because to get somebody to replace, you're going to have to find a really top-notch coaching candidate to replace Budenholzer if you're talking about just kicking a guy to the curb who led your team to the best record in the NBA back-to-back seasons. Like, that's a very high bar, and to have to pay two coaches. We're already talking about a team that wasn't willing to dip into the luxury tax to pay Malcolm Brogdon, which we'll talk about again briefly. I know that conversation topic might get old. We'll touch on that real briefly. Before we leave the topic of Coach Bud, did you get a sense or was there an explanation given? I think one of the more puzzling decisions was not playing Wes Matthews in crunch time against Jimmy Butler. He'd had some success defensively against Jimmy Butler, and Wes Matthews, of course, is a defensive stopper. He's a guy that has handled, among others, LeBron James this year, handled, maybe too strong, but he's had success for sure. He wasn't there in points in this series when the Miami Heat really took control. Did you get a sense as to why? Was it maybe just because Wes is he's on the downslope of his career, and maybe the minutes count would have been too high for him? Like, how did you take that in?
That was never explained. The question was asked, it was never answered. Bubba just kind of, give a generic answer of like, well, it's hard. You have to make decisions, and it's tough decisions, and we just decided to go with the guys that we had out there. And it's like, okay, but that doesn't really make that much, sense, looking at, the Bucks offense wasn't great down the stretch of most games. And so I would guess that he'd be putting other guys out there to be able to have more creators on the court, more shooters and things like that. Which, Wes, for the most part, has just been a guy who spots up and shoots threes. So maybe having different guys on the court could be an option, but they also need to get stops. And Bud would kind of, he would always just say, well, they made tough shots. And yes, they made tough shots. But could those shots have been tougher if Wesley Matthews was out there? Could those shots not have happened? Could those shots have been denied, or the ball been denied from getting to, Jimmy Butler in those situations? If Matthews had been on the court, I think that's entirely possible. But we never got an answer. It's hard because, it was a little inside baseball, but we with the Zoom interviews that we had, there's obviously a lot of people who want to ask questions of the Bucks, and it basically got to the point where each person could ask one question. And so you ask your one question, and then it wouldn't get back to you to ask another question. And so it's not the same as being in person where you can talk to multiple players. You can be in the locker room and discuss things with different people, or be able to ask follow-ups or get guys to the side after the interview scrum is done or whatever. Like, there's no avenue for getting those extra answers. So it's just kind of a bummer that that opportunity, that access wasn't there. And I wish I had a better answer.
Yeah, there are going to be a lot of questions asked of Coach Bud going forward about his minutes usage, about Wes, about everything. So we'll be talking more about that, because that's not a storyline that's going to go away quickly. Wanted to talk about some of the players in this series, starting with Chris Middleton. I wonder if the Last Dance being on when it was during the pandemic has sort of once again re-emphasized the idea that you need a strong number two, a star number two, in the vein of Scottie Pippen. It feels like that's become an archetype, the Jordan Pippen way of winning championships, having a superstar and a number two. That's always driven me crazy. We've talked about it before. I think Chris Middleton is, maybe he isn't what people think of as an elite number two, but he's capable of leading this team. He stepped up big time in game four to help the Bucks survive and send this to a fifth game. Didn't have his best game in game five, but he was the guy that everything was running through. I look at the Raptors last year. I'm not sure they have a clear-cut number two in winning the title. I mean, Kyle Lowry, Pascal Siakam, Fred VanVleet, all very good players. I think that it's more of a team, though, that what you saw last year. The Mavericks when they won, the Pistons when they won, even the Spurs. There are a lot of recent examples in my mind of teams that don't have that crisp, clear-cut number two player. I don't know if I'm right about that. Maybe there is something to it. We've obviously seen teams like the Heat have sort of a top flight number two, certainly the Bulls back in the day. I've seen what I saw from Chris Middleton wasn't him taking a star turn to the next level of appreciation across the NBA, but I think he held his own. What did you see from Chris Middleton in this series? Do you think that he has silence some doubters? Do you think the doubters are still going to be there next year? I mean, how do you think he comes out of this series?
Yeah, I've been saying it all year. I think Chris Middleton had a really good season. I think that there was a lot of pressure and a lot of attention on him. You know, coming off getting the a near max deal last summer, and I think he responded well. He's going to be an all NBA player. Like, I don't know when the NBA is going to announce its all NBA teams. They haven't been telling us at all when they're going to announce things. They just announce them.
Yeah, things just pop up. It's crazy.
Yeah, which is not ideal.
John Morant became Rookie of the Year while I was driving to the grocery store one day. Like, it just is like, oh, we're doing Rookie of the Year now. We're doing Defensive Player of the Year now. It's weird.
Yeah, I mean, I don't like it, especially since the Bucks are very much involved in a lot of those regular season awards.
They should have announced MVP before Game 5. I know that for certain, because now it's going to get awkward.
Yeah, so, you know, all that said, like, Chris Middleton is going to be an All-NBA player. Whether, you know, I think it's likely going to be third team. But being ranked as one of the top 15 guys of this NBA season is incredible. Like, I don't think we can overstate that. I don't think anyone had expectations at any point in Chris Middleton's career that he would be an all-NBA player. And yet, like, I believe he has earned that. He has stepped up. He has shot the ball really well. He's become a bigger part of the offense. I think his passing is underrated. I think he just does a lot of things on the court that are underappreciated. And in the postseason, you know, I think he took on a heavier load. He didn't always have great games, but I think he played well. I think he left it all out there on the court. I mean, you look at game two, where he was plus 18 and played 33 minutes. And I know a decent amount of that was foul trouble, but still, like, that game two is a game that's going to haunt the Bucks for a while, because, you know, Middleton was great. You know, and Giannis, you know, did enough, you know, and you know, they made that furious comeback at the end. In general, they didn't play well enough. And I think that it's pretty fair the way things ended up. I think the team that had played better most of that night deserved to win the game and did win that game.
Totally.
But the Bucks had put themselves in a position to potentially win, and they could have put themselves in an even better position, you know, maybe by playing their guys more. You know, plus 18 in 33 minutes in a game you lose by two is just devastating. And so, you know, like you said, I don't think this is Chris Middleton's huge star turn, but he showed up. You know, I think he played well. You know, over the course of the playoffs, he averaged 20 points a game, only shot 39.4% from the field, but he was 35% from three. You know, almost seven rebounds, six assists per game. I think he was good. And the Bucks are going to need him to continue to get better and continue to play at the level he played at in the regular season, even when opposing teams are keying on him and are throwing multiple bodies at him and are you know, forcing him into tougher looks than he would normally like. I mean, he normally likes pretty tough looks, but even tougher than he would normally like. But so far, I mean, it's hard to knock the guy. It's hard to say, like, you know, he did not play well after getting the bag. Like, he got paid. He put together a second All-Star season, a likely All-NBA season, was out there grinding it out. I mean, the 48 minutes he played in the overtime win game four, while they don't win the series, while they don't, you know, amount to a hill of beans at this point, that was a pretty special performance, and I think Bucks fans probably needed that. They probably needed to have one last thing to feel good about, you know, with the way the season has gone. And I think he gave that to them. You know, I would expect that he's someone the Bucks continue to build around. Obviously, they're going to have to retool, retinker with their roster going into the off season. But I would be surprised if he's someone who doesn't stick around to continue to build alongside Giannis and whoever else is there.
I definitely found myself drawn to wherever number 22 was on the floor. Even when Giannis was out there, I do feel like Middleton is a guy that, you know, my experience isn't everyone's, but I'm not watching where he is when he's off the ball, because I know that he's capable of doing something a special that he can hit from just about anywhere on the floor. Yeah, he takes tough jump shots, sometimes 1 foot inside the arc, as maddening as that can be, but he hits some big, big buckets in this series. And, you know, my feeling about, to revisit this Malcolm Brogdon conversation that we've always had, because this has come up, some writers, Jonathan Jarks in particular, but a guy who I really respect, an NBA writer, but there's a few out there who believe that the Bucks made a big mistake by not bringing back Malcolm Brogdon. And I think that's a fair thing to say. In my head, it's always been an either or with Chris Middleton. If the Bucks brass decided they didn't want to go into the luxury tax, Brogdon was really off the table when they re-signed Chris Middleton to that close to max deal. Now, you could argue that it's an either or because he plays the same position as Eric Bledsoe. They signed Bledsoe during the season, much, much earlier, and got some cost certainty there. You could say that the Bucks chose Bledsoe over Brogdon, knowing at that point they were going to let him go. I'm not sure that's how I would look at it. I feel like all those guys could have come back if the team elected to go into the luxury tax. I think they just made a value choice on Brogdon and said, he's not a guy that we absolutely, absolutely have to have. Now, maybe that's the wrong thing, but now you're seeing it sort of reframed as Bledsoe versus Brogdon, and Bledsoe having struggled in this series, just really struggling on offense in particular, especially in Game 5. It was really bad. He's developing a little bit of a reputation as hit or miss in the playoffs. I happen to think for the majority of the playoffs, he was fine. He was good. He's solid defensively, and you know he gave them some energy when they needed it. I thought he was really good in Game 4, but you know he's carrying this reputation now. He has not stepped up in every situation in the postseason. And now you're seeing this they should have kept Brogdon instead of Bledsoe, whatever. So what is the future in your mind for Eric Bledsoe? Do you think the team is going to have to move on from him? Do you think they just try to get him to get a little bit better? I mean, I don't know. You know, he's not a spring chicken. I don't know really where Bledsoe fits into the future here. And we don't even need to frame it with the Brogdon thing, but just Bledsoe in general after this series, I think has some Bucks fans scratching their heads.
Yeah, I think the issue with going to the luxury tax and all that, I don't think it had anything to do with Chris Middleton. I think Chris Middleton was always somebody who they were going to be comfortable bringing back. He was part of the plan. I think that the decision was probably between Eric Bledsoe and Malcolm Brogdon. They made that decision early on Bledsoe. They made it before he, you know, then struggled in the playoffs last year and almost immediately called that extension into question through his play. And yeah, like the Bucks, you know, they had a championship window this year and they decided not to go into the luxury tax. I mean, Mark Lazary even said, I believe it was in the offseason before the season started or sometime like almost a year ago, he even said, like, you know, they believe that signing Malcolm Brogdon was a luxury and that they didn't need to and that they decided they were good with who they had or they could better use the money elsewhere. And who knows what would have happened, you know, had they gone all in and brought back Brogdon, brought back Bledsoe, found a way to get Brooke Lopez back. Maybe you don't get George Hill. Maybe you do get George Hill. You know, maybe you don't get Kyle Korver, Wes Matthews. Like, who knows how all of that shakes out? There's a lot of moving parts to all of that. But they made their choice, and their choice was not to go into luxury tax to save the money because it would have cost them a lot. They would have, gone into the tax, you know, this year, next year, probably the year after, they'd be hitting the repeater tax and they would just be, you know, spending money like crazy. And I think they made a calculated choice to take the risk to not bring back Brogdon and to see if they could, you know, build around the guys that they had, the guys that they're going to bring in. And during the regular season, it looked like it was good enough, right? Like they had built this, you know, team that for a long time was on a 70 win pace. And that looked to be one of the most dominant teams in the NBA. But the problem is when it came to the playoffs, they just didn't have enough guys that could create offense for themselves, who could get buckets, who could score with consistency, who could break down defenses. They just didn't have it. It was Giannis and Chris and maybe sometimes Brooke, but not really because he's kind of limited to doing it kind of out of the post. You know, Eric Bledsoe, for as much as he got to the rim and made things tough for opposing defenses with his driving ability. We didn't see that enough in the playoffs. Like, he was able to drive and kick and find guys for assists, but he couldn't get anything for himself, at least not on a consistent basis. And that's a problem, especially in game five where, you know, there's no Giannis. And so everyone is, you know, kind of keying on Middleton, keying on Bledsoe, making sure to keep particularly Bledsoe out of the lane. It just didn't work out. Things kind of fell apart the same way they did last year. And so I don't know what the future is for Bledsoe with the Bucks. Obviously, he's on under contract for a couple more years at a reasonable amount, somewhere, I think, probably around league average for starting point guards, maybe slightly below, but, you know, in the ballpark. But like I said before, him and Giannis both being non-shooters is a problem for the Bucks. When you have multiple non-shooters on the court, that's going to make it easier for opposing defenses. I mean, you look at the Houston Rockets, right? Like, they've obviously skewed like way to an extreme with their decision to go super duper small. But a lot of that was predicated on the fact that they had Russell Westbrook, who is kind of a non-shooter. I mean, he can shoot the three ball, but he's not a very high percentage shooter from there. And they also had Clint Capella, who at center wasn't a guy who touched the court at all. And both of those guys like need the lane, which makes it easier for opposing teams to clog it. So what did the Rockets do? They got rid of one of their non-shooters, which was Capella, and they chose to go really small because that allowed Russell Westbrook to, in essence, be their center, at least offensively, where he's the guy who is now going to have a whole bunch of room in the paint because there are four shooters on the outside. So, you know, you can only do a Giannis plus four shooters offense if you have four shooters. And Eric Bledsoe, you know, has not been a good enough shooter to make that work, particularly in the playoffs. And so we'll have to see if the Bucks are going to stick with him to try and, you know, find ways to help him improve, or if they're going to test the market and see if there's someone out there who is interested in taking on Eric Bledsoe, and if they can bring somebody back who can fit their offense better while still bringing, you know, maybe not the same level of defense as Eric Bledsoe brought, but bringing something close, something that could, you know, keep them solid on the defensive end while raising their ceiling on offense. I don't know who that person is. I don't know who that trade partner is. I don't know anything about that, but I do know that that's something that the Bucks, you know, at the very least should be exploring, because we've had three postseasons worth of the Eric Bledsoe experience, and it hasn't paid dividends.
No, and I think probably the biggest concern is to sort of expound on what you're saying. The path forward for the Bucks to getting better isn't clear, really. And I mean, you know, obviously they hit on Giannis in 2013 in the first round of the draft, no questions asked, a pick with the 15th pick. They probably got a little good fortune, good scouting, whatever you want to call it. You could go all the way back to 2005 when they drafted Andrew Bogut, and in that interim not find another quality first round pick. I mean, guys who've had roles, you know, John Henson was drafted, Jabari Parker, you could maybe chalk up to bad luck with injuries and whatnot, but the draft history for this team hasn't been great. And obviously the way they've played, it's not like they're getting top five draft picks anytime soon. So the Bucks aren't going to get a ton better through the draft. You look at how they've tied up this roster with financial commitments to, you know, to guys like Chris Middleton. They certainly made sense at the time. And I don't know what kind of wiggle room they have. You know, they're not going to be capable of going out there and just acquiring Chris Paul or something. Yet again, another aging veteran. I'm not even sure if that's the type of player the Bucks would be looking at this point. Without giving up just a ton of guys, like they're locked in on some of these contracts. They lack some financial flexibility. Something I'm not sure we've interrogated is that this roster is pretty old, and guys like Dante DiVincenzo, kind of that next wave. Dante really struggled in the bubble. He certainly had his moments in this series, hit a huge free throw in game four and did make some plays, look good at times, especially in game five. But, you know, DiVincenzo has not taken the leap forward you maybe hoped he would after really promising flashes at the start of the year, whatever, you know, back a year ago when the season started. So I don't know, like, the path to getting better, I don't know what those moves look like. I don't know what the Bucks can do to just go out there and retool this team to where they're better. I think a lot of these guys are back next year, and after this the way this exit took place, you got to wonder how much better the Bucks are going to be in 2021. How do you look at that? What's the course that they have to chart to get better?
I mean, I think it's all going to come down to, are they going to make a big swing? You know, they haven't taken any big swings in the past couple years. They've gotten better by, you know, being good on the margins, by getting Brooke Lopez for a song, you know, for bringing in a bunch of, you know, solid veteran guys on cheaper contracts. You know, they've gotten better by bringing in a coach who had a kind of a clear vision when they didn't really have one. And so all those things led to some regular season success. But they haven't been good enough to get over the hump, to get to the finals, to win a championship. Like they haven't done that. And so when do the Bucks take a big swing? Like, when do they make a big move? You know, bringing back Chris Middleton was kind of like a your hands are tied type situation. Like, he was really good. He was going to get paid on the open market. You can offer him more money. And so you have to keep your guys when you have them. You know, they made that choice, and I don't think it was wrong, but they made it. You know, they were able to, you know, develop Malcolm Brogdon into, you know, a great player, or at least pick him, and he became a great player. You know, but he's not there anymore. Their draft picks have not been hits, as you mentioned. DJ Wilson and Sterling Brown, they didn't play in this series. You know, Thon Maker is gone. You know, Rashad Vaughn is gone. Jabari Parker didn't work out. The picks just haven't panned out. And I think DiVincenzo can be somebody who can be a solid quality rotation player for multiple years. This is basically his rookie year after he lost most of his actual rookie year to injury. But I think now is not the time for the Bucks to be trying to make, you know, incremental changes or get better on the margins. Like, they need to do something big. And that's my perspective. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I think that they need to make a big swing. You have one more year with Giannis Antetokounmpo certainly under contract and on your team. And you can control whether or not he gets traded, right? Like, he doesn't want to be traded. The Bucks say, hey, we don't want to trade you either, so we have you. Like, it's happening. So what do you do in that year? How do you prove that you're willing to win and do what it takes to win? Draft picks aren't going to do it. They don't need one more draft. The Indiana Pacers draft pick they got in the Brogdon deal, who cares? You know, whoever the 24th pick is, I don't think that that's going to be someone who's going to put them over the top this year. So they need to figure out how to take the players that they have, the contracts that they have, the picks that they have, whatever assets they have. They need to figure out how to take those and turn them into someone or multiple people who can take them to another level. You know, they have Giannis and Chris, who I think are bona fide all-stars, who are legitimate, really, really good, high-level NBA players. But you need somebody else, I think, another all-star caliber player, and I don't know who that is, I don't know where they come from, who can create their own shot, who can break defenses down, who can just add a different element to the Bucks next season. And that's going to be their challenge. And they're probably going to have to figure out, you know, if they're willing to pay the luxury tax. They weren't last year. Are they going to do it this year? And who are they going to pay it for? Like, who are they going to get that they're going to say, you know what, this person is the addition that we needed, and we're willing to pay more for that player. But it's time for the Bucks to take a big chance, take a big shot. Otherwise, they may run out of time to take those chances or not even have those chances.
I just I look at the free agent list. I just don't know who that player could possibly be. I know it's not just free agency, you know, but Anthony Davis is probably the only guy who's truly a superstar that's going to be coveted out there. Brandon Ingram's a restricted free agent. But Davis, you know, I think everyone sort of mostly expects he's going to stay with LeBron James and the Lakers. I mean, that would certainly be a good situation. I mean, maybe it's a DeMar DeRozan, Gordon Hayward, Mike Conley, but like, I don't know if those guys are even what we're talking about. Montrezl Harrell. I don't know if those guys are the big swing that you're talking about. And trades obviously can be just, you know, even more tricky. So I'll be fascinated to know what John Horst is able to pull off or what he's able to even investigate at this point. Going back to the Supermax situation, I think it's kind of, at least it seems clear to me that no matter what happens, Giannis probably isn't going to sign that right away. There's no reason to sign it this second until he sees, A, what the financial situation is going to be, and B, what the Bucks are going to do to make this team better so that he has all the information he can. Yes, you said this. The Bucks don't want to trade him. Of course they don't. But there's going to come a point, a panic point, where it's unclear if Giannis is going to sign. They might have to do something drastic to keep this franchise viable. I don't. Maybe the Bucks ownership is just content to go right up to the deadline and let him walk if he chooses to do that in unrestricted free agency. Maybe they do. Honestly, that would be my guess. But am I wrong about that? Is there a point where they're going to say, either before the season, early in the season, by the trade deadline, is there a point where they're like, we have to know what's coming next. We would be willing to move Giannis for the right deal.
No. And unless that right deal is like a multiple team deal that ends up bringing back like Zion Williamson and Luka Doncic and like LeBron James, like it's not happening. Like they're not gonna get rid of him. Cool. This is gonna be like the Raptors last year, where they didn't know what Kawhi was gonna do in the summer, and he was gonna be an unrestricted free agent, and they had no control. And they were like, you know what? Cool. We're just gonna like try and do all the right things to convince him to stay. And if he gets us a championship and leaves, then go with God. like no one wants to be the owner or the GM. Or the team that trades Yaz Adetokounmpo. No one wants to be that person. And so, you know, the Bucks are going to do everything in their power not to be that organization. Like, this is their chance. This is a once in a generation opportunity. You know, the Bucks had Kareem and Oscar, you know, back, you know, 50 years ago, or almost 50 years ago. This is their second chance they've had at a superstar generational talent. They are not going to give that up for anything if they can help it.
Props to Masai Ujiri, who not only went all in, like you said, and did not entertain trading Kawhi Leonard, got the championship, and somehow got that team to a level where they were able to be the number two seed the following year without Kawhi Leonard. I know that some of the holdover talent, like Kyle Lowry, but that is some impressive work. From the Toronto Raptors, they, as we record this, though, on the doorstep of their own ouster from the playoffs, down 3-2 to the Boston Celtics. Boston-Miami, fascinating potential Eastern Conference Finals. Again, two teams that don't have, like, star one and star two. I think Jimmy Butler is more the straw that stirs the drink than a superstar, although he, you know, could be thought of as a superstar. Just two solid teams, two very tough, interesting teams. I'll be fascinated to see those guys go up against the West, which is built more on some superstars. I think the biggest frustration that I would have as a Bucks fan is knowing how much this set up for Milwaukee. I mean, I'm just talking about that. The East doesn't have teams with superstars on them. Kevin Durant is injured. He's in the East, but wasn't going to play this year. The Nets were largely a non-factor. The Golden State Warriors are down, just besieged by injuries. You know they're going to come back and be an elite powerhouse team, or at least one, you know, they're aging, but up there again next year. Maybe the Lakers take a step backward. Maybe the Raptors take a step backward, but the Heat are obviously ascending. A lot of young talent on that team. It feels like the obstacles get bigger and badder next year for the Milwaukee Bucks. I don't know if that's how you would look at it, but you know, right now, I don't know if people are going to come back next year and say, oh yeah, the Bucks should still be picked to win the East. If most things stay the same, they add some pieces. I don't think the Bucks are your favorite to win the East anymore. Am I wrong about that?
No, they're not. I mean, if all things stay the same, which they won't, but you know, coming off of this season, I think people have, you know, they're going to have a reticence to trust the Bucks. Because of what they've seen each of the past two seasons. They've gone from a darling and, you know, a great feel-good story with the way they ascended last year. And then they made it to the Eastern Conference Finals, not an easy place to get to. And then they've, you know, got up 2-0 and flamed out. You know, they they came back, they retooled, I think they, in some respects, got better. And they had a great regular season, and then they flamed out even earlier this year in more spectacular fashion. There are problems there that people just aren't going to trust. And you're right, like, the East is going to get even tougher. The Nets are going to be a team to be reckoned with, among the already, pretty deep group of teams to be reckoned with in the East. Toronto is still going to be good. Like, Boston is still going to be good. Miami is still going to be good. Indiana, like, they're always just around. Like, Philadelphia.
Yeah, we haven't talked Philadelphia yet.
Yeah, who even knows what the Sixers are going to look like? But they're going to be good. Like, if they have the guys who they have had, that is a team of stars and all-stars that can do some stuff. So we don't know what a lot of things are going to look like, but that's the frustrating thing for, I'm sure, for a lot of Bucks fans. This was the year. This was the chance. This was the time that everything seemed aligned, best for the Bucks, and they didn't do enough to take advantage of it, and they didn't do enough to earn the opportunity to still be playing. Those opportunities are few and precious, and for whatever reason, the Bucks weren't up to the challenge in the bubble. They didn't look like themselves or the team that they had been in the regular season during the bubble. And it's impossible to pinpoint exactly why, whether it was the long layoff or the pandemic as a whole, or playing without fans, or their focus on social justice, or anything like that. Like, there has been, there are so many things that are going on that you can't pinpoint one. But the end of the story is the Bucks weren't good enough, and they didn't do enough to earn the opportunity to still be playing.
I was just going to ask you to try and speculate if we could sort of summarize. I know we've said this now a couple times. There isn't one thing. We all know there isn't one thing that you can point to that says that can suggest why this team went from, the best defensive team in the NBA and offensive powerhouse to being just a team in the bubble. I don't want to gloss over the social justice thing. We haven't mentioned it to this point. I don't want it to be lost that I think people will recognize that this team did something pioneering that goes beyond the sport of basketball. They took a stand that hopefully will, lead to some change, unclear, but at least showed us that pro sports can unify behind certain ideas, shows us where pro sports wants to stand. The players anyway want to stand. And I thought that was very compelling and something that we will be talking about for a long time, depending on the fallout, but something we'll probably be talking about for a long time. But I guess here's how I want to frame this question. Do you think it was the Bucks' destiny to run into these issues? Even when things were going great, there were certainly no shortage of people, national writers, who could tell you, okay, well, the Bucks can be beaten. But there's also national writers saying, this Bucks team, nobody even realizes how historically good they are. They were on a 70-win pace for a while, which is, the elite of the elite. The Golden State Warriors at their best, the Bulls at their best. Those are the only people who can cross into the 70-win threshold. So they were on course to do some historic things. I know that there was maybe some doubt, probably stemming from their historic performance and not having been to the finals in decades. But do you think it was that the flaws that we saw were destined to show themselves in a playoff series? Or do you speculate that really just the bubble created an environment that maybe exacerbated what their issues were, or maybe full-on created what their issues were?
It's just so hard to say. They could have run into all these problems in a regular playoffs, right? Like, this could have still been the matchup. It very likely would have still been the matchup, right?
Right, right.
It would have been Bucks against probably Magic in the first round, and then it probably would have been the Heat and Pacers in the 4 or 5. It could have been Heat Sixers. The fact that the Heat were the 5 seed is kind of neither
misleading.
It's misleading. It's neither here nor there, because they were in the 4 seed, and could have earned the 4th seed had, they played the Pacers in the last game of the bubble season, and they were just like, oh, who cares? We're going to play these guys, for a whole series after this. It doesn't matter where the 4 or the 5 seed. Home court doesn't matter. Let's just punt.
I don't think anybody thinks of them as the 5 seed. Nobody thinks of them as like a first-round upset or anything.
No, not at all. So this could have been the matchup anyway. And I've long thought this could be a tough matchup for the Bucks, and you know, obviously that came to fruition. Is it a little bit different if they have home court advantage and the Bucks are able to kind of feed off their crowd and use that to their advantage a little bit, maybe be more comfortable at home? Maybe. You know, of course they won two home games last year against the Raptors and then lost four in a row. So you know, you just don't know. I think they would have run into some of these same troubles. You know, Eric Bledsoe and Giannis playing on the court at the same time and not bringing enough shooting was probably still going to happen. You know, Giannis running into a wall on defense and having to figure out how to create around that or through that was probably still going to happen. You know, the Heat, being a great three-point shooting team and knowing how to find the gaps in the Bucks' drop scheme defense, that probably would have happened anyway. I don't know if the series would have gone the same way that it did. I think in a lot of respects, the games were closer in the bubble than maybe the score would indicate. I outlined earlier, like, the Bucks had chances to win pretty much all of the games. And they just weren't able to execute, particularly in the fourth quarter, or they had, you know, big lapses for stretches during the game that you know, kind of put them in holes and they couldn't dig their way out. So I think it all could have happened anyway. I think they could, you know, this could have been something that happened back in May. You know, but the bubble being what it was, the Bucks never found themselves there. They never, you know, consistently played well down there, and you know, we'll never know what could have been, but we know what was, and you know, the Bucks weren't enough.
Any last thoughts, Matt Velasquez, before I let you go? We obviously went long, a lot of meat on this bone. We're going to talk about, I mean, the schedule is still so uncertain. We don't even know when the free agency period begins or when the MVP award is going to be given out, which we know is going to be Giannis, but weird. I don't know if there are any last thoughts you have before we start to tiptoe into the off season.
No, I guess I just wanted to thank anybody who's been listening all year, or even if you're just listening now for the first time and you're getting to the end of the podcast, I appreciate you being here. Thanks for taking this ride with us. I know I've had fun doing the podcast with you, JR, so it's been great doing it, and yeah, I'm just really appreciative. Like, anytime I've had a few instances where people have brought up the podcast, like, oh yeah, I know someone who listens to the podcast, or I heard this podcast, that podcast. Like, I'm just always floored, and it's just such an honor that people take the time to listen to us and you know, hear the petty horn and you know, be involved with some of our nonsense. So I just appreciate that, and I just wanted to thank everybody for following along all season.
Definitely echo those sentiments. We're not quite done, as we mentioned, there will be some off-season machinations, but not necessarily next week or the week after that. We'll have to figure out the schedule as the NBA figures out the schedule. There's a draft at some point in the future, not sure when, but it's all going to be revealed in time. Matt Velasquez, thanks for joining us, man. We will talk again as soon as we are able. Hope you found us on Stitcher, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Leave us a rating and review. We'll, like I said, we won't be back for a while, but we will be here when there's news to discuss. There's draft, there's free agency, there's the Giannis situation, there's maybe the Budenholzer situation, all the stuff we've talked about. We will be revisiting again when the time comes. So for Matt Velasquez, my name is J.R. Radcliffe. Thanks for listening to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel Bucks podcast. We will catch you again.